forum for frank talk about what people do for a living. Works do.
Hello, and welcome to Works Do. It's April 5th, 2011, and this is episode number 5. I'm Kate Gace Walton. I'm the editor of WorksDo.com, an online collection of essays in which people ponder their work lives. Today I'll be interviewing Ben Wisner, the litigation director of the ACLU's National Security Project. I wanted to talk to Ben because his path, pursuing a career in public interest law, is very different from the path taken by Mark Britton, the last lawyer I interviewed who was in corporate law before becoming an entrepreneur. At the ACLU, Ben has litigated numerous cases involving post-9/11 civil liberties violations, including extremely high-profile lawsuits challenging the CIA's extraordinary rendition program. Today we'll go straight to the interview. So I'm talking today with Ben Wisner, who is the litigation director of the ACLU's National Security Project. And Ben, thank you for taking the time to do this.
It's my pleasure.
Ben, I wanted to start by just painting a picture of what exactly it is that you do. And to do that, I wanted to step back a little bit and talk about the ACLU more broadly. We all know it certainly at the headline level, but how do you define the ACLU's mission?
Well, that's not something that I expected to be asked, just because I think everyone has their own idea of what the ACLU is. It's been causing a lot of trouble for about 90 years now. But in general, we defend the Bill of Rights, and that can take a variety of forms, some of them a lot more popular than others, and some of them more popular now than they were some years ago. In my little patch of grass, it means working on issues at the intersection of national security and civil liberties. But we also work on immigrants' rights, gay and lesbian rights, racial justice, free speech, the death penalty, really a whole sort of cornucopia of rights violations and rights remedies.
And the issues that you personally work on, how did you find your way to those issues and to the ACLU? What was your path to the work that you're currently doing?
Well, really accidentally is the answer to that. I mean, I started at the ACLU in August of 2001, just about 5 weeks before the 9/11 attacks. And so I could not have contemplated at that time that my legal career would involve litigating torture cases against the United States, traveling to Guantanamo, working on targeted killing, all of these things that I would have associated when I was in law school with what other countries do and not what the U.S. does. So this really was accident and circumstance. After the 9/11 attacks, when there was a backlash and when there were all of these policies aimed at Muslims and South Asians, when secret prisons were opened up around the world, when we began to torture prisoners, you know, the ACLU needed to organize a response to all of this. And so we formed what we now call the National Security Project to work on those issues. And when that happened, I joined it.
Okay. It's interesting that you mention, in some ways, falling into this by accident. That's certainly a theme that is emerging in a lot of careers, the more people I talk to. When you were in law school, what were you thinking you might do? Did you have a clear vision of what you'd pursue when you graduated?
Well, I think there are big decisions that you have to make as a law student, and then there are more sort of smaller and granular decisions. I think the big decision I had made, and that was that I wanted to use a law degree for people and not for property. And that sounds a little bit glib, but what it means is that I knew when I started law school that I would do something in the public interest. I had no interest in, you know, being on the 40th floor of an office near Wall Street and moving money around between corporations. Not principally because I thought it was morally wrong or useless, but because I couldn't imagine spending all day doing that. I had a law school professor who said something really terrific, which was that you should surround yourself with colleagues who you love because you're going to spend many more of your waking hours with them than you are with your friends and family. And so I knew that I wanted to work in an environment with people who, you know, shared my progressive values, who wanted to do something progressive in the world. I was not an arrow pointed at the ACLU by any means. I spent my first law school summer in Louisiana working in juvenile prisons. I then did a lot of death penalty work in Alabama and elsewhere. And I graduated from law school without a very clear picture of specifically what kind of work I wanted to do. You know, since this is a podcast about work, I'll tell you more details. I went out to Los Angeles when I finished law school to clerk for a liberal federal judge. And at the end of that year, when I still hadn't decided what to do, I had lunch with his wife, who happened to be the executive director of the ACLU of Southern California. So you can add nepotism to accident and circumstance in describing how I ended up doing what I'm doing.
I like that. So drilling down a little bit into what you actually do, is there a case that just sort of sticks in your mind as emblematic of your work at the ACLU? Is there one that maybe you're particularly proud of or concerned about? What kind of floats to the surface when you think about highlights?
Well, I think there are a lot of highlights on cases, but I think that if I go right to that, it'll give people the wrong idea of what my day is. Because I think the work sounds sexier than the experience of coming to work actually is. Like everyone else, I spend a huge amount of my day sitting at a desk deleting email in an office in front of a computer. Having gotten that out of the way, I will say that when I'm not doing that, and the cases that I'm working on, the briefs that I'm writing, the arguments that I'm making, are about very, very interesting subjects to me, at least. You know, I think the case that that is closest to me in some way was the most disappointing loss, a very bitter loss. I represented someone named Khaled El-Masri, a German citizen who was abducted by the CIA in a case of mistaken identity. He was rendered to Afghanistan, a country where he had never been, stripped and chained to the floor of a plane, injected with drugs, put in a dungeon for several months where he was tortured. They realized they had the wrong person. He was then blindfolded, brought back to Europe, and dropped on a hill in Albania. And this became a very important public case. He really was, in some ways, the public face of the CIA's extraordinary rendition program. The details were known throughout the world. And yet when we tried to bring his case into court to get him some recognition as a victim, get him some compensation for his ordeal, the CIA invoked the so-called state secrets privilege, and no court in the U.S. has been willing to hear his claims. So although that was a loss, I think it was really part of the process in the last few years of changing the discussion in the United States about torture, away from what rights should terrorists have to what happens when you abandon the rule of law, what kind of mistakes might get made, what kinds of tragedies might occur. And so that was a very meaningful case to work on, a very exciting case to work on.
Right. Now, you've been working on those kinds of cases under two administrations, if I have this right. Has it felt very different going from one administration to the next, or is it frustratingly similar?
Well, I think both is the fair answer to that. You know, I certainly think there are people in this administration, people who are probably my friends and yours, who are committed to some of the values that I'm committed to. I think when it comes to holding government officials accountable for crimes like torture and illegal surveillance and providing a measure of compensation and recognition to victims, there has been a frustrating continuity between the administrations. I don't assign any kind of moral equivalence. The last administration was run by war criminals, and this one is run by people who called a halt to the most abusive practices that took place. But when it comes to actually reckoning with the consequences of what went on, coming to terms with that in a formal way, allowing a court to adjudicate whether torture is legal or not, this administration is as tied to the national security state in some ways as the last one was.
I see. one thing that I wanted to talk about with the case that you just mentioned, I read a New Yorker article, I'm sure you know the one I'm talking about, and it focused in on a day, I think it was a day that you spent with that client driving around Manhattan. Would you mind telling that story?
It's kind of a nice story because this is a client who, again, was being treated by the courts as a state secret. And yet we were able to get him into the United States. Remember, this is someone who was never charged with a crime by the U.S., someone who was an innocent victim, a case of mistaken identity. So we were able, with some difficulty, to get him into the United States. And he was in the courtroom in Virginia in a federal court observing while I made arguments on his behalf, which was quite meaningful. But during that time, he was sitting next to a Washington Post reporter named Dana Priest, who won a Pulitzer Prize in part for covering his case. And she asked him, you know, what do you want? what do you dream about? What would you like? And after talking about some of the things that he wanted in relation to his case, he said, what I really want is to drive around New York in an open-topped car and look up at all the buildings. Now, it was the end of November, early December. Not so easy to rent a convertible in New York, but when we read this in the Washington Post, it was the first we heard. We thought the least we can do for this person, who is this innocent victim who came to the U.S. to tell his story, who really has shown a lot of courage and sacrifice, is to accommodate that wish, that dream. And so we borrowed a Mini Cooper convertible from my boss, the director of the ACLU, stuffed five grown men into it, including a New Yorker writer, and drove around Manhattan. And one of those people was the talk of the town writer for The New Yorker, who wrote a really memorable piece about it.
It is a really, really lovely piece.
You know what? I should have quit after that. I think that was the pinnacle. I think that actually was the high point. I mean, how do you top it? I should have gone to cooking school at that moment, and I could be a chef by now.
I can't imagine. One thing I actually really appreciate about what you said earlier is you didn't go straight to that pinnacle, or I imagine you have others to point to, that you did take the time to say that a lot of what you do is what all of us do. Because one of the things I'm hoping to do with WorkStew is to not give just the glossy sheen for these various jobs, but to give some sense of what it's really like. And so turning a little bit more to that side.
Let's break it down a little bit.
Are you willing to discuss the downsides of what you do? Do you ever have doubts? Do you ever find your work depressing?
Well, before we get to downsides, let's talk a little bit of brass tacks, and then we'll get to downsides. But you know, what I do, we call impact litigation. That's what lawyers would call it, as opposed to what you might call direct services representation. So, you know, a public defender or a legal aid lawyer does direct services, has 40 or 50 or 60 or 80 clients, is in court every day arguing some motion or a case or going to trial. I'm sitting on the 17th floor of a building with security downstairs, sitting at a desk, and mostly what I'm doing is reading and writing. It's a fairly academic practice. Most of the litigation before federal courts involves submitting briefs in writing, not standing up and pointing your finger and waving and making passionate speeches. And certainly not going to trial in front of a jury in this kind of work. So, you know, that's something that people should keep in mind when, you know, they consider whether they want to be ACLU lawyers or some other kind of lawyer, that, you know, it is both a benefit and a drawback that in practicing constitutional law, you really are engaged in some ways, another law school seminar. It is quite academic in that sense. So that's a bridge into talking about the downside, I think, because, you know, having done direct services work before I went to law school, having spent a few years doing advocacy for the homeless in New York and having clients and going into courts where on a daily basis you had some concrete sense of what you were doing for other human beings, here that can be quite attenuated. You know, I might be working on 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 cases at a time total. And it might take years for those to be resolved, and they might not be resolved in our favor. And so you have to have a much longer sense of what kind of movement you're in, because most days of the week I don't do anything for anybody else. I don't have a result that I can point to. I don't have some victory, you know, that I can drink to. And especially working on the kinds of issues where I work, where we lose most of our cases, actually, you have to have some different kind of sense of movement in order to even feel like you're doing anything good. So I would say that that is, you know, for me, one of the downsides, that I would, at times, I feel like I would rather have closer contact and connection to the people who on whose behalf I'm working and have more to show for it, in a sense. You know, the flip side and the bonus is that I get to work on the issues of the day, the things that are in the newspaper, the things that are being debated, these big issues, I get to work on and respond to and do it in a way that is intellectually stimulating, you know, not the way politicians have to, where they have to reduce everything to a soundbite that really dumbs down the debate.
Right. Now, that's a very nice balanced presentation of it. Are you willing to end with any predictions about Guantanamo? I know you've been there many, many times.
Well, I think that Guantanamo, in a sense, is not even really the issue anymore. The question for us, and we're now coming up on the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, is how do we want to define the struggle with terrorism right now? Do we want to define this as a war that essentially will take place everywhere and last forever? And that's been the approach of both administrations, to say that we're in a global war against either terror or against Al-Qaeda and associated groups, which really means that people can be picked up anywhere in the world, delivered to the military, and held without charge or trial. To me, that theory of the kind of struggle that we're in is much more important than the bricks and mortar prison at Guantanamo. And I think it's a dangerous one. I think that we've really lost sight of who we are. You know, this idea that we should still be acting as if our country is in a state of emergency 10 years after this terrorist attack is already a defeat for our way of life. And I think we have to have a little bit more courage in the face of these kinds of threats. Most Americans shouldn't be thinking about terrorism at all, ever. There's nothing they can do about it, and it's not going to affect them. And for it to remain the dominant political issue of our day, a decade removed from this attack, I think is a failure on the part of people like me, but a bigger failure on the part of our political culture.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben. That's been very helpful. I really appreciate your taking the time.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for calling me.
That wraps up the show for today. Thanks again very much to my guest, Ben Wisner. Also, Chris Walton, my husband and collaborator. This podcast would not be possible without his technical expertise. Thanks also to everyone who has contributed an essay to Work Stew. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening today. The next episode will be released in 2 weeks, and I hope you'll check it out. In the meantime, please let me know what you thought of the show by sending an email to kate@workstew.com, by posting a comment on the Work Stew website, or by writing a review for iTunes. Thanks again, and bye for now.